I have to tell the people about the Patreon.
Yes, you do. Patreon.com/SMDB. SMDB, like so many damn books.
For just a dollar, you can join up and you get access to all the exclusive content that I record just for the Patreon. Also, you get to join the book club. Oh, there's so many damn books book club. It's been some of the best conversations I've had about books.
It really always sounds like a blast. I'll usually like come home and just hear like giggles coming from the library. So it's a great time. You should join.
And I would love to have more people join the fray.
You may or may not know that Christopher runs this whole show himself on the hosting side, on the technical side, everything. This is a one-man show, truly. He does it all. Support your boy, Christopher.
Even at the dollar level really helps. So join up. Patreon.com/SMDB. I'd love to have you.
Patreon.com/SMDB.
On with the show. All right. So we're just going to, you have any questions? You ready to go? You ready to talk books?
I think so. Yeah.
I mean, aren't we always ready?
So many damn books.
Welcome to So Many Damn Books, a blessing, a curse, a podcast. My name is Christopher, and I am so excited to be joined in the Zoom version of the damn library with Rachel Lyon. Rachel, I am so excited to have you back. You were last here in the nexus of So Many Damn Libraries for episode 84.
Yeah.
Which is, and now we're, I think this is episode 200 something. So,
my gosh.
So that should say how long it's been, but I'm so excited to have you back. Rachel Lyon is a teacher and writer whose work has appeared in One Story, Rumpus, Electric Lit, and many other places. And she's the author of Self Portrait with Boy, as well as the brand new, awesome, everyone go out and buy it, Fruit of the Dead. It's great to see you again.
Likewise. Thanks for having me. I can't believe it's been like 120 episodes.
I know. It really doesn't seem that long ago when I think of like that episode and talking to you on that couch in what I believe was Drew's apartment back then. It seems like seriously not that long ago at all, which I guess it isn't in like the scheme of.
Yeah. But also I think it's because we're in like the So Many Damn Books library state of mind, right? Like we're just like back here in this place together. So
yes. Yeah. And to celebrate being back in this place together, I have created a new drink inspired by your book. And the drink is called Candy of the Dead.
Nice.
And so you have a cocktail in your novel called the Fruit of the Dead that is served, but it's some pomegranate and lime, and then also some vodka and the drug that you made up, granadone. And so I decided to forego both vodka and granadone to make my own version. And when I was trying to think of what to sub in for these things, I was thinking of Corey, one of the two main characters of the book, who is a young adult who still has some childlike tendencies, one of which is to just grab handfuls of candy whenever there's some around, which was like one of my favorite character moments. There's always like grabbing some sour gummy worms on her way someplace. And so
is that childish? Is that not something that everyone does?
I mean, I do it. But
I know what you mean.
It's got an endearing sort of childish quality to it. Mm-hmm. From someone who's pretending very hard to be older. I just don't see a handful of gummy worms as the most refined. But so I decided to try and see if I could make a syrup from what I used was sour punch straws. Partially just because that's what I saw, and also because it made a straw and it actually does work as one.
Ooh, I love this idea.
So I made, I cut up sour punch straws really small and boiled them in water until it became a syrup that is actually not separating like I thought it would. It's really delicious. It's got so much of that sour punch citric acid in it that it balances out with the pomegranate juice. And yeah, I don't think that Rolo would serve this at any party, but I think that Corey would like it. You know, that's
a great drink for a teenager.
Perhaps.
My kind of drink.
Are you drinking anything special over on your side of things?
I just have my like nightly. Do you see how big this mug
is? Oh my gosh. Big as your head mug.
Yeah, big as my head mug full of mint tea with like an obscene amount of honey in it.
So, you know, honey, sour punch straws, there's all sorts of sweeteners in this world.
Yeah.
If you are at home thinking, I want to make my own sour punch straw syrup, usually it's a 1-to-1 ratio for water to sugar, but the water kept boiling off. So use 3 or 4 times as much water as you think you need in this process, and definitely learn from my mistakes and use a nonstick pan, because that wasn't fun. But it is a fun drink, and I'm glad I have it. So thank you for inspiring such a delicious drink with your book.
Yeah, I'm excited to try it sometime. I wish I was drinking it right now.
Yeah, I wish I could just hand one to you. The problem with the Zoom damn library is that makes it nearly impossible. But one thing that is possible is to talk. What did you buy? You bought anything cool recently, Rachel? Or had anything sent to you?
Yeah. So I just, you know, when your book comes out, one of the rituals involved is getting presents for your agent, your editor, your publicist, right? So I went on like Zazzle and got them some designed some like compact mirrors, like oval compact mirrors with like the pill capsule from the front of my book on it. So the containing, you know, the Bernini sculpture of Persephone and Demeter, or Persephone and Hades. So that's the most sort of interesting thing I've bought recently.
That's great. That's a great gift for people.
Yeah. I was sort of like wishing they looked a little fancier. They're kind of basic, but you know, if I could have had it in like gold.
Coulda, woulda, shoulda, you know.
But yeah, I hope they like them.
Yeah, I think they've got to. I got a couple great books. I was at the Pete's Reading Series a couple months ago, and I saw Jamie Nakamura Lin read from what is billed as a speculative memoir, this book called The Night Parade. And I've never heard of a speculative memoir, and I'm really getting into this sort of creative nonfiction space. And this is sort of an adaptation of a Japanese folktale, broken into the traditional Japanese 4 acts about her experience with bipolar disorder. Undiagnosed bipolar disorder in her childhood. So, and then it's also illustrated by her sister. It's a really beautiful paper overboard hardcover. It's a really pretty package. I really am excited to dive in, and hearing from it, it just seems like a really cool project and way to explore some difficult stuff from your past.
Yeah, that sounds so good.
And then the other thing that I got that I'm really excited to read, which has an incredible cover that I'm just going to show you, which is just a beautiful like oil painting of what looks like the most delicious cheeseburger, for a novel called Piglet by Lottie Hazel. And it's about a cookbook editor with a nickname she hates, who comes undone when her fiance betrays her.
Ooh.
So when she finds that out, she has to decide, like, am I going to go through with my wedding? And as she's like dealing with that, she starts to really lose it. So I don't know what all that means, but I'm very, very excited to check that out. I love the character of a cookbook editor. I just feel like that's a fun place to be starting.
Yeah, that's great. And wow, if you bought books by their cover, For sure, that would be one of the first.
Right? Just, you know, especially if you're kind of hungry when you're in the bookstore. So it's time. Let's dive into your novel, your brand new novel, Fruit of the Dead. Do you mind telling the listeners what it's about in your words?
Sure. So Fruit of the Dead is a, you know, a contemporary retelling of the Persephone myth. So if you know the story, it's, you know, Persephone's hanging out on the surface of the earth, picking flowers with her nymph friends when Hades sort of like the earth opens up underneath her and Hades sucks her down to the underworld or brings her down in a chariot, depending, you know, and makes her his queen. It's sometimes called the Rape of Persephone. And then Demeter, her mother, the goddess of the harvest, sort of drops everything to hunt for her daughter, and no one will tell her where she is. While Demeter's gone, the crops on the, you know, everyone's crops die and there's a famine, and, you know, but it's interesting. It's sort of like the gods are like protecting Hades, right? So they don't, a few of them do know where Persephone is, but they don't tell her. Eventually she finds her daughter and has to go down there and negotiate with Hades to get her back. And Persephone has eaten 6 pomegranate seeds while she's down there. I wonder how long she was down there, but she's eaten 6 pomegranate seeds, and apparently nobody told her that's, you know, that binds you to the underworld forever. So she's, you know, has to stay there forever, according to Hades. And the solution they come up with is that she'll be on the surface of the earth for 6 months a year and in the underworld 6 months a year. And so that's ergo spring and, you know, the seasons. So my book is a very contemporary sort of reimagining of that idea, where like Corey is like 18 years old and working at a summer camp that she used to go to and feeling sort of aimless and like a loser. And this wealthy pharmaceutical CEO spies her and hires her as the part, as the nanny, temporary nanny for his kids. And she becomes sort of, she signs an NDA and he whisks her off to his private island, and she ends up becoming sort of enamored by his life and his world and this drug that he has not yet brought to market. Meanwhile, her mom, you know, freaks out and goes hunting.
Right, right. I love a fictional drug. I think they're always fun. Like, I love a book that features one. Will you talk about creating Granadone?
That's funny. Yeah. So when we were writing up, you know, jacket copy and galley letters and that sort of thing early in the production of the book, I had a sort of like send out a memo, like, it's not an opioid. Because it was like, it's very tempting, I think, to call it an opioid when you're talking about the book, because Rollo Picazzo, who's the pharma CEO, Hades proxy, is he's going through this like congressional hearing process reminiscent of like the Sackler family trial. But it's not an opioid. It's like referred to as a painkiller, but as you'll see if you read the book, Corey's experience when she takes it, it feels a lot more like benzo meets psychedelic a little bit, right? Like things get kind of stretchy and time loses its meaning and she gets long and short and like, you know, so it's like a little bit more like an Alice in Wonderland effect than like anything a real drug could do.
I love that stuff though, because it is couched in that sort of scientific speak that I really like. And so it feels very realistic, and it does feel, I mean, part of the realism to me, I guess, is Rollo Picazzo himself and how he like administers it to her. And yeah, he seems like an extremely difficult line to walk for a character, you know, a snake that we have to believe could seduce Corey.
Right.
That seems like a difficult line to walk.
Yeah, I mean, the book actually began like not as a retelling of the Persephone myth at all, but just more as like a exploration of what the gray areas in a relationship can look like. You know, I had this idea of writing about a woman who, a young woman who becomes involved with her employer, and like it all kind of sprang from there. But like that's, it's so tricky. It's such a tricky, you know, space. And I did feel pretty strongly that I didn't like, I don't want Rollo to be despicable. I don't want him to be like a sort of one note antagonist. Like he has to effectively seduce her, which I think means he has to effectively seduce the reader. I don't know if he does, but that was my intention, right? So
When you're trying to seduce the reader as a villain, you know, where are you finding inspiration? Is it in the Sackler family in the public sphere, or were you looking to other myths?
I did follow the Sackler story, you know, in the paper, which was, there were like a lot of protests going on at the time that I was writing those sections. And then I, you know, I watched that totally awful, you know, heartbreaking Jeffrey Epstein documentary. It was like a 5-part documentary about like this horrible man. I'm like, why would anyone put themselves through watching this thing? It's so disturbing. But outside of those sort of real world influences, yeah, I was like thinking about men I've known. Like, there are guys out there who are like really have this kind of persona. Rollo, one of the things I really wanted to communicate through writing Rollo was how he feels put upon. Like, he feels like not necessarily a victim, but like the vulnerable one in this relationship. You know, he feels like he would never see himself as a predator, you know. And like Jeffrey Epstein for sure is like a great example of an actual sociopathic predator. Like, I don't think he falls into this category. Like, Rollo's a lot more, his like self-perception is like, he, you know, he's like a, he's this son of a waitress, and he worked his way up, and he's been hurt and damaged by women in the past, and you know, and like he feels he has no boundaries. Like, he feels totally comfortable telling Corey all about himself, right? Until like, anyway, and Corey has no boundaries either because she's too young to have learned them. So she's sort of the perfect prey for this particular kind of predator.
I loved meeting her in summer camp. Summer camp is this like total otherworldly space. I didn't get to go to summer camp as a kid. I did do a one summer as a counselor, and I just wanted to know your summer camp past and bringing the summer camp to life.
I feel like I can see you as a summer camp counselor.
It was so fun. Yeah, no, it was a great time.
Yeah, I didn't go to like a quintessential summer camp either. I played violin really seriously when I was a kid, so I went to like music camps. I went to one that was like a real camp, which had like a pond that you could swim in and like activities like capture the flag. And then also you played in the orchestra and, you know, had lessons and stuff. But then I went to this other one that was much stricter, and like there were no activities. It was like you practice 5 hours a day and you get your lessons, and you know, by the end of the summer your technique has improved, and that's the point. So it wasn't until I was a grown up that I like spent a little time as a staff person at the summer camp that my partner went to, actually. And I worked there 2 summers, and in some ways I think, yeah, River Rock is sort of based on that place.
It's very idyllic. I wanted to go back to something you said about how you didn't know that you were adapting, or that only showed up later. When did it show up? And did that like clarify things? Was or you know, what are the pitfalls or pleasures of adapting myth?
Yeah. I think I was like 2 years into working on it, and I had like, a bunch of material. I felt like I had stuff about, I had scenes between the young woman and the older man. The guy's name was already Rollo Picasso, but her name was Erica. Anyway, fun fact. So I had that stuff, and I had some like, yeah, like power dynamics, squeaky, like love scenes, romance scenes, and then it just wasn't feeling robust enough. You know what I mean? Like it was like, what is the point here? Like, what's the real meaning of this? And it was around the time of the Me Too movement, and I was thinking a lot about how, the response of so many men during the early part of the Me Too movement was like, what, all of a sudden you've all been sexually assaulted? Like one out of four women has, like it was like a why now kind of response. And I guess I wanted to demonstrate without demonstrating too intensively that like this is an ancient problem and has always been an ancient problem. And so I found that the myth actually mirrored the structure of the book that I was currently writing, this like descent and return cycle shape of the Persephone myth. So I was really drawn to the myth, like working with the myth more closely because of that. And then, as I started working with it, I was like, oh, there are all like these like fun Easter eggs to explore, and I can throw this in, I can throw that in. And it turned into like a really kind of generative process.
Are there any particular myth Easter eggs that you can highlight for us?
Well, they have an Easter egg hunt, which is a meta Easter egg in the book. Virgil is the name of one of the characters, which is a reference to Dante's Inferno, which is not the myth, but is another story of descent and rising from the underworld back up. Cerberus is represented by three dogs named Sarita, Birdie, and Ursula.
That's great. I love that. I don't know that one I missed. I really love that. So from in Self-Portrait with Boy, I have this notion of fiction that I keep using that book as like when I first encountered it, the dread plot where you're just waiting for something that you're expecting to happen for the entire time, where in Self-Portrait with Boy, it was like eventually she's going to have to talk about what happened. This has a completely different structure. This has this cool double helix braid structure of Emmer and Corey. I'd love to know how who is easier to write. And I feel like we've talked a lot about Corey, but Emmer's side of this is just as compelling.
I think Corey was easier to write for me. Well, Corey was how I began the book, right? So Corey was my entry point. She was like the idea of being young and vulnerable to a certain kind of predation was really the starting point. But as I wrote and started a family and became a mother myself, Ymir's perspective became kind of unavoidable. So there's a lot of my own experience in Ymir, as well as in Gory, but just much more recent. I mean, I think Corey sort of flowed better. There's like a looseness to her narrative voice or her perspective that felt like sort of fun to play around in, and a sort of verboseness, maybe even. Like Ymir is much more sort of controlled and like a totter, I think, narrative voice.
Corey's like having a nice time most of the time, tripping half the time, versus Ymir who's panicking. Basically, from page one, it is actually one of my favorite things in this book, is how Corey tells Ymir via text, like about getting the job, and the full lack of information that she is giving, and then she loses her phone. I mean, and then you see that from Emer's perspective, and it is even more horrifying. Like it's bad all over again. These two perspectives, it gives this great explanation for why there is no cell phone for her, which sort of does away with the modern problem of cell phones and plots. But I also think that is really used to your advantage even further, because it's really scary to be in a place where you aren't reachable now. Like it's not, right. It's so strange, and it's a bizarre state to be in, to be unreachable, because we are so reachable. So it's not, you feel the danger encroaching because of it.
Yeah, totally. It would suck to be lost on Rolo's Island without a phone.
I love going to an island with a crazy house on it. Can you talk about building Rolo's house?
Have you had that experience?
What?
Of going to an island with a crazy house on it?
No, but I just keep reading books about it, you know? The Magus by John Fowles, you know? All the way up to recent guest of the show, Kirsten Backus's new book, King Nyx, which is also about going to a crazy house on an island.
I'm going to have to get all these recommendations from you.
Great structures, yeah. Well, everybody can go to somanydamnbooks.com and click on the episode, and you'll see all of the books listed out. It's a great resource if you're ever like, hey, that sounded like an interesting book, but I'm not writing anything down right now. I'm listening to a podcast. You don't have to.
It's written down for you.
Yeah, I do it for you.
One of the books that I was reading while I was working on this as research was Stay Up with Hugo Best by Aaron Summers. Did you ever read that one?
Yes, yes.
It's fun. It's such a fun book. And it's a similar kind of setup, right? Where this young woman sort of ends up in this powerful man's. In that case, I think it's like a Long Island, like summer house, right?
Yeah, of her favorite, you know, late night host.
Yeah, yeah.
I always pictured Dave Letterman, but yeah.
I was picturing Jay Leno. That's funny. But yeah, like the idea of being sort of contained in a space which so clearly, like, you have no power, right? This belongs very completely to him, and everyone who works there is beholden to him. And like, it's a really scary scenario to an adult.
Yeah.
Who knows better?
I love that your book fits into these fun different micro genres. You've got the crazy house on an island, you've got person in thrall to richness that they don't understand. I love seeing a space from a point of view like that, that is either coming at it from a perspective that was never supposed to see the context, like they would never understand all of the stuff about it, so what they focus on is really interesting. And so Corey's perspective as she walks through the house is very, it just feels like a very alien space.
There were like a couple of different spaces that were coming to mind while I was working on this. One of them is this place, Star Island, which I worked on. I worked there when I was 22 and then again when I was 24. And it's not a luxurious place. It's like a sort of a rustic hotel on the Isles of Shoals off the coast of Maine and New Hampshire, a very tiny coast of New Hampshire. I worked in the snack bar, and it was like, so the sort of scenes between Corey and her coworkers and like gallivanting around the islands, you know, the archipelago, are all kind of inspired by that space. And then I was thinking of like some houses belonging to like when I was a kid, I had a friend who had like a really, you know, glamorous grandmother who like lived in this house in Westchester with like a stone wall. And like, it was like really modern. And we would like go through her beautiful dresses and like play dress up, you know, with her stuff. And it all just felt like another world. Places like that, right, that have sort of like imprinted on you. I don't know about you, but I feel like we have like a limited number of like imaginary houses that we like use to imagine the houses that we read about. You know what I mean? Like in your mind's eye, when you're reading about like a standard house, like I feel like I always go back to the same few houses that like imprinted on me when I was like a kid.
I'm always surprised when I am reading a book and they've gone into some sort of detail about the place, and I'm like, okay, yeah, I think I've got that right. And it turns out to be a real place, and you check and you actually do have it. You know, you basically did get it
Wow.
basically right. And it's from, 30 words that you were able to sort of like see Versailles, but it was,
Wow.
I feel like that's something that for me, it's one of the pleasures of reading is that
Yeah.
like it's got this sort of, I keep thinking of an AI word, which is annoying me, but generative fill. Like it's like, oh yeah, just like that's, I've got a castle in my head, sure, like you're saying, but
Yeah.
they add a couple of things to it and I feel like I'm with them.
Totally. Like you've got your standard castle, and
Totally.
then the book supplies all the generative fill where it's like, okay, yeah, but this castle is like purple or like has like, deep
Exactly.
walk-in closets or yeah.
What the author doesn't know is I've started at like the castle from, Monty Python and the Holy Grail, like the friend, like that's the castle that I've is my standard. What else were you reading while you were writing this? Was there anything else that was notable?
So I was working on this during for like 5 years. So I read a lot of things. But like some of my influences, I guess I read like Maggie Nelson's Argonauts during this period, and the way that she talked about motherhood, pregnancy, like really influenced me, I think. And I read Moby Dick while I was writing this. But you probably won't see the influence of Moby Dick in the
But it did grab you.
Moby Dick?
Yeah.
Yeah, I loved it. But I was also, it was like June of 2020. Like I like was seeing no other human beings. Like I was reading it like by climbing out of my window onto the roof below and like sitting hugely pregnant, like sitting in like a beach chair. In the sunshine, like that was my vitamin D for the day, was like going out onto the roof and reading Moby Dick. Yeah, so it was a very singular experience.
That's a beautiful image. I love that. I need to read Moby Dick. I still haven't. And I have started it a couple times because it's one of my partner's favorite books. So I'm going to get to it. And I've even really liked the beginning that I've read it. Just
Oh,
other
yeah.
things keep popping up when I'm trying to read it.
You might even say there are just so many damn books.
You might. I love when other people say it. I always want to. Okay, well, speaking of so many damn books, you gave me a list of books to choose from that you were thinking about. What brought it to mind?
Well, this book has actually become really precious to me, because its structure. So for those who haven't read it, it begins with a section called the present. And then after like six or seven chapters, it goes into a three-chapter section called the past, and then ends with a very short section also called the present. But really, so I loved that structure. One of the books, actually, back to your previous question, one of the books that really influenced me while I was writing Fruit of the Dead was Lisa Halliday's book, Asymmetry, which is structured in a similar way, right? Which it begins with one kind of novel, halfway through switches to a completely different story, and then ends with this kind of like coda that's back in the world of the first section. Not to mention, I just like Tessa Hadley's writing is exquisite. It's like I'm completely in love with her style. But anyway, because of reading this book over the summer, I started a new project, and it's that's gonna that's the my current novel project, which was sort of semi-inspired by this idea of going back in time, and like getting to see your adult characters as children, which is
Yeah.
like just find that so exciting. Like, as like the second we got to see Harriet as Hetty when she's a kid, it's like, oh my God, my heart. Like, this woman, this like repressed, you know, English woman with like this unattractive haircut, was once this imaginative and sensitive child. And it's just, yeah, I think as a writer, it feels very dreamy to me to get to do that kind of character work.
We should say, plot wise, such that there is a plot, because it isn't the most plotty book. It's a pretty big family is coming together at a family cottage for a 3-week summer holiday. And they haven't been to the cottage altogether in a while. And it's three sisters and a brother, and then some of the kids. And I was immediately drawn in because one of the first things that she references is one of the characters reading an E. Nesbitt novel.
Mm-hmm.
And I love E. Nesbitt. All of those books meant a lot to me as a kid. And so I was actually getting primed for magic. Because, I mean, it's got this really, like, you know, the past is overgrown on the cover. And so I was thinking actually that it was going to delve into true, like, fantasy. I mean, we're in this summer cottage. There's beautiful fields. There's like a river running through the property that they're going to play in. It just seems like it was about to, at any minute, someone was gonna, you know, encounter a magical creature. That doesn't happen. but I was primed. I'm primed for it. And I think, you know, it leads into kind of what you're saying, that she's playing with the whole time is this kids versus adults understanding of the world. And I love an early moment in the book is from this younger kid, Ivy, perspective. And she writes the perspective of a kid's tantrum. And it's such a great section, you know, to be able to dip into that mind. And you're dipping into all their minds. You get to see a little bit of everybody's perspective on the situation, which is always a writing feat.
Yeah, no, it's incredible when a writer is able to really do that. Yeah.
Yeah, it reminded me, actually, I was thinking of the Patrick Melrose novels by Edward St. Aubin, who is fantastic at that as well. But just sort of that sort of playing with the past and going back and thinking about things. I feel like Tessa Hadley, I had this note in my notes app about it, that this is dust mote fiction, which so some movies, when you go into an attic, you're just in an attic and it looks dusty, but some movies there's dust motes and light spilling over, and the camera is going to follow some of the dust motes and the light as they go over things.
Yeah.
Tessa Hadley is very much in the second camp. She's never going to just walk into an attic or another cottage. She's going to go into how the light is spilling in things and how the air feels. There's never a time that she's a full five senses writer.
Oh, totally. Totally. And you know what I appreciate too about her is, like, she's not just describing for the luxuriant feel of, like, describing things. Like, you know, you wouldn't, if you were in a workshop with Tessa Hadley at your MFA, you know, you wouldn't be like, cut, cut, cut. You know, it's always in
get
service.
Rid of this.
Yeah. Even though it feels everything that's described, like, is described in a way that feels fresh and exciting and telling about the experience of the characters. And because the story is about, like, how we change, you know, as people over the course of our lives, like, it's about perception. So it always felt to me like that description was in service of that ultimate message of, like, the changing of perception and, like, evolution of not just the people, but the place, right? The place that they are this summer home. Which, like, you know, like, there's, like, a cottage that's, like, literally becoming part of the earth again, you know, in the wood. And even within that, it's, like, sinking. She describes it as, like, sinking into even the church is sinking into the graveyard. Like, everything's kind of sinking and becoming overgrown. And within the cottage, like the kids discover like this dead, you know, decomposing dog that they knew it was alive, right? Mitzi, like, it's Mitzi. Is it Mitzi? You know, they have this whole childish, like, back and forth about it. And one of the kids is clearly like, he's like, doesn't know how to process it. But the other one is old enough to, you know, kind of bully him into not, she doesn't want to talk about it. But I feel like that's the thing. Like, that's the fantastic creature you were hoping to see in the woods, right? Is this like decomposing Irish setter that's like on the floor of this old, nasty old cottage in the woods.
She captures something too that I think is very like endemic to childhood. The like, I have a really important information and I think I'm just going to keep it to myself because I don't know what'll happen when this information gets out. I could get in trouble and it's not even my fault. So this is not information that anybody else needs. And so like that was another thing that I thought she was really, really good at depicting.
Yeah.
It's such a slow burn book.
Yeah.
There's I see in reviews this word over and over, restraint. And I think it's because like there is some stuff that like another writer would make a huge meal out of that she either doesn't return to or just lets thrum under the surface and not, you know, become a shouting match that everybody knows the information.
Totally. Yeah, it's very, I think it's probably very English that way, right? It's like nothing, it doesn't ever boil over.
Have you read other books of hers? This is my first one.
I have. This is my favorite of them. Oh, I read Late in the Day and Free Love. Yeah. I think I liked Late in the Day better than Free Love. They're all like these sort of interesting, subdued, like examinations of relationships with this like sort of incredibly specific, but like dust mote kind of descriptions. Yeah.
I was also thinking about, because I was reading this so close to reading Fruit of the Dead, just comparing Corey's experience to Molly's. Because Molly is an 18-year-old who is unexpectedly, there's a friend of the family joining them, an ex-husband's kid that has come along. And they have this sort of very sweet summer romance. Sweet-ish. I mean, you get weird vibes. I got the weirdest vibes from him. But
yeah.
I mean, compared to what Corey is having happen, it feels much more sweet. Or I mean, maybe it feels a little bit more of like what she has with Honey Bowl, I guess.
Honey Bowl. yeah, it is like that. I was, you know what I really liked about Molly as a character is that, you know, people keep referring to her as sort of dim, like she's supposed to be kind of like pretty and dumb, but like at the same time Kasim, who falls for her, is like, he's like, she's like the deepest person I've ever met. And he's older than her by like significantly a few years. Anyway, I think, I don't remember exactly how much, but this question of depth and superficiality in girls, I find like endlessly fascinating, especially in a character, you know, like in a character that's given that much page time and really treated with respect. Like she's never written off, you know, she is kind of a curious, compelling, beautiful character. And the reader doesn't really know what to make of her either.
She's still remote to me, you know, afterwards. Like I still don't think I got a handle on her, but I think that's because she's like still very much becoming herself.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, I'm so glad you brought this book to my, I remember when it came out because it had a very beautiful cover. Like I remember this book around and it catching my eye. But I have to admit a plot like this doesn't always make me want to pick it up off a stack. Yeah, so I was really glad to slow down with it because it is a nice, like, sumptuous, very summer. Like, it feels, you feel the heat of an English countryside summer.
When I was rereading today, I saw that section when they're sort of pelting each other with like sod or moss, like near the stream, and it's like written as if she's like, it was so hot, it was sort of pleasantly as if they were all in slow motion. I was like, yeah, that's the vibe that I need in February.
Yeah. I definitely needed some sun. I felt like I got it while I was listening to it. It's a great audiobook, actually. But as long as we're talking about recommending great books, why don't we move into the wonderful art of recommendation? Do you have anything you would like to recommend to the stalwart listeners of So Many Damn Books, or would you like me to go first?
You go first.
Well, I just finished this book today, and the first thing that I'll say about it is read it fast. If you're going to take this recommendation, you should read it fast. It's called Everyone in This Room Will Someday Be Dead by Emily Austin. And it is like the most claustrophobic mind I've been in a long time, about a woman who is depressed and thinking she needs to go to therapy. And so decides, I'm going to go to group therapy. But when she gets to the place on the flyer, it turns out to be a Catholic church. Mm-hmm. And when she goes in trying to find the group, she gets hired to be their new secretary instead. And as she's there, she's also a lesbian who is, and it's not a progressive Catholic church at all. So she decides to try to keep this job because she needs one. She'll have to go undercover basically as a heterosexual woman while she's there. And then she also discovers that there's a bit of a mystery in the woman who had the job before her. But the entire book is an anxiety spiral. She's going from anxious mind all the way through. So the whole time you're just like, oh my gosh, like, I hope you get out of this okay. Like, I really haven't been so worried and so also like, please talk to somebody about a character in a really, really long time. And it's also really funny, but every moment of levity gets cut off at the knees by like basically whatever happens next. Everybody in this room will someday be dead, which is a great title, which is why I was interested in the first place. I recommend it.
That one reminds me of a book, or your description of it reminds me of a book that I read a couple months ago called The New Me by Hallie Butler.
Oh, yes.
It's speaking of anxiety, I was like, oh, just like, am I enjoying this? I don't know, but I can tell it is really well done. And the audiobook is read by her, and she's a great sort of wry voice and a good reader of her own work. It was quite an anxious listening experience in the best way.
It's cool that she reads the audiobook. I think, you know, if the author really has the desire to do it, it can be really great.
Yeah. Yeah.
You ever want to read your book?
I wanted to read my own, but they discouraged me from it for the funniest reason, which is there are two. They wanted to do it with two narrators, one doing Corey sections and one doing Emer sections. And they were like, if you're reading alongside like a seasoned actor, you might look bad. So we're not going to let you do it. I was like, that's fair. Thank you for protecting me from myself.
Wow. Wow. That's some real honest feedback. That's amazing.
But I have to say the book I read recently that I really loved, that's sort of sticking with me right now, is Splinters by Leslie Jamison, which I just found like so interesting, like deceptively, it felt deceptively easy, like as a book, like I was like, did this just kind of like fall out of you, you know? But it's clearly, you know, really beautifully crafted and thoughtful, and brings up a lot of thorny questions that I really enjoyed it. Yeah.
Do you want to recommend something else?
I do. I want to rec I do. Thank you so much for asking. So this is the first re-release, I think, of a book by Elspeth Barker. It was written in the like latter half of the 20th century, but I'm not quite sure when. Elspeth Barker was writing, and like she was born in 1940 and died in 1922, but she like wasn't well known. She taught Latin at what she described as a naughty girls' school on the Norfolk coast. She's, according to the flap copy, she's like a Scottish writer,
Okay.
not very well known. And this book, O Caledonia, is about an unlikable woman named Janet. And much like some of the other stuff we've been talking about, it begins when Janet is dead when it starts, and she's 16, and her body is like lying in her family castle in Scotland. And then it zooms backward, like it starts again basically when she's a baby, and follows her through like POV baby through her like childhood and adolescence and into her teenagehood. And it is like so funny and so weird and like neo-Gothic, and like there's like a lot of like moody Scottish moors and like angry like Catholic nannies, I guess. Like it's really dark and funny and a lot of fun, so I can't recommend that highly enough.
That sounds great.
Yeah.
As long as we're recommending things, I always like to recommend for people to join the So Many Damn Books Patreon, patreon.com/SMDB. There you find all sorts of things, like you can read along with the show. I announce who's coming next to just those people. You get special Patreon-only episodes of the show, as well as you can join the book club, which we will be choosing the April title in just a couple days. So it's a really good time to become a member. Only costs $1, and you can be a part of all that fun stuff, as well as I do send you a bookmark and a sticker in the mail now. So that's fun. So do that, and also go and buy Fruit of the Dead. It is such a electrifying reading experience. You're hoping for so many good things to happen to these characters who seem to be hell-bent on bad things happening instead. But it really is. It was so great to be back in your voice, and it's so awesome to have you back here talking. It's so great to see you.
Likewise, thank you so much for having me. This was really fun.